Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Hello everyone and welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. This is the show where we speak to key thinkers, philosophers, politicians and journalists about their political values and how these may have changed with recent political events. My name is Alice Thwaite and today I'm with someone who I personally find to be a bit of an inspiration as she's done so much over the years when it comes to strengthening public debate and also pushing freedom of speech. So I'm with Claire Fox. Claire is the founder and director of the Institute of Ideas, who run a fantastic conference every autumn called The Battle of Ideas. She's also the author of a book called I Find That Offensive, which came out this year, and it talks about the decline of freedom of speech on British and American university campuses. So Claire, thanks very much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
Great. So should we just go straight into this and start
of course,
off by talking about how you would personally characterise what your core values are, so your political beliefs, and perhaps even your morals?
Okay, I think it's very difficult in the contemporary period to label one's political beliefs because there's so many misunderstandings around. I will attempt to try and describe what I believe, but it is difficult because I think that concepts of left and right that served us well, for 100 or so years in the last century are increasingly meaningless in this century. So I historically am from the Marxist left. I was the publisher of LM, which was Living Marxism magazine, and, would have been in the 80s and 90s involved in a traditional left-wing politics. So now I find myself in a situation whereby that has so little meaning outside of a kind of seminar room or a whole range of caricatures that it doesn't begin to even explain where I stand on issues. So I've increasingly been labelled as a libertarian, as a left-leaning libertarian, but I don't even like that phrase particularly, but I think it does indicate one of my core values, which is liberty and freedom, which I think is the bedrock of what it means to be a human. And if I wanted to stretch myself into having a label, I suppose I consider myself to be a liberal humanist in the tradition of Enlightenment thinking, very much about saying that man is the measure of all things, that humanity can take control of its own fate and not be determined by external forces, but actually actively act as an agent to make things happen and change things for the better. And at the same time, the liberal part of that is an emphasis on the need to treat each and every human being as equal and free in society.
So you talked about the fact that the label might have changed over the years, but would you say that everything you've just spoken about when it comes to humanity can take control of its own fate and the fact that you're a liberal humanist, has that been with you since the beginning, or is that something that has grown over the years?
Well, I think that historically Marxism had all of those components. It came out of that liberal humanist tradition and chose to, and wanted to kind of expand and make deeper that whole tradition and make more meaningful rather than it just being a slogan. So I'd say, of course, that I don't think I fundamentally changed my views, but I'm aware of the fact that one of the things about anyone, I think, who's involved in politics is the need to be sensitive to the contemporary period that one lives in, rather than just kind of treating political ideas or ideology as a dogma where you kind of cite the passage and the quotes and the books that you kind of take inspiration from. I don't think that's very helpful. It means that we get stuck, and it means that we stop thinking. So in the contemporary period, I'm much more aware of issues that in the past just wouldn't have had any meaning. Something like identity politics just wasn't a feature of the political campaigns or rows or disputes that I was involved in the 80s or 90s, that it was a very marginal affair. Whereas at the moment, people are much more interested in defining their identities through their cultural, ethnic, religious backgrounds, say. So they see themselves through their identity through the prism of something that's already given to them, rather than the idea of forging yourself as a new individual. So consequently, I've had to think about what I think about identity politics in a way I wouldn't have previously had to do. And so a similar example might be something like environmentalism. Again, not an issue at all for those of us involved in politics 25 years ago. So it's become a kind of dominant, so sort of seen as natural that we would now think that humans are destructive because we've destroyed the planet, which I think ends up in a kind of very negative anti-humanist endpoint, and has led to a kind of orthodoxy around risk aversion, nervousness about scientific breakthroughs, nervousness about the future and technological solutions and that sort of issue. That just wasn't something that ever even came up. It wasn't on the horizon. So consequently, I mean, if anything, a kind of green politics, such as it was the preserve of a kind of conserving conservatism, if you see what I mean. You know, people who were kind of interested in nature were not people you considered to be part of a kind of radical political movement. But as you'll know, that has become quite a major feature of what passes for left-wing radicalism today. So I find myself at odds with a lot of contemporary left-wing thought on environmentalism. And that then will mean that people will say, oh, so are you right-wing and do you support neoliberal growth, or, you know, and so on. Mm-hmm. So we've lost sight, I think, of some of the basic principles, which is, I know, one of the reasons why you want to have these kind of conversations to kind of unpick some of these things.
Definitely, because what's so interesting about what you just said there about kind of identity politics and about environmentalism, I think a lot of people would class those as kind of left-wing values these days rather than necessarily events. So that's a really interesting perspective to have, is to try and unpack what people believe in terms of, you know, humanism with an event or an idea, which I suppose is environmentalism. And it would be interesting to hear views from subscribers when it comes to that as well. So a key question here is, we've kind of picked up on two things. Well, actually, identity politics, because identity politics is being blamed a lot right now for recent political events. This kind of idea that it's been rejected by a lot of, I suppose you could say, working class people, or just people who voted for Brexit and Trump. I'm doing huge generalisations here. How have you interpreted the upset of Brexit and Trump this year? What's your perspective on that?
Well, let's start with the identity politics issue in relation to Trump to start with, because I think it's more of a feature of the politics of America than it is particularly of the UK in relation to that particular vote. I think if you look at the way that Hillary Clinton viewed the electorate and her team viewed the electorate, they very much view them through the prism of demographics and identity types, you know, the women's vote, the Hispanic vote, African vote. And you've got this sort of peculiar situation where people were not taken seriously as voters who had to be convinced of a particular ideology or vision for the future, but it's kind of clumps of homogenous people who you could kind of tick off. So it was assumed, for example, that because Trump made those really gross comments about, his locker room banter about grabbing women, it was assumed that that would mean that the women's vote would stick with Hillary and would abandon Trump. Whereas in fact, a lot of women voted for Trump despite his comments. Not because, as many Hillary Clinton voters have subsequently said, that they were in denial and got a huge amount of internal misogyny, which is one way of dismissing their agency and patronising at it at the same time. But because a lot of women said, well, yeah, we know all that, but what we were interested in and what we were listening to was what he was saying about economic development or infrastructure, or we just were interested in the fact that he wasn't one of the establishment and that he had something new to say. And so I think that, and similarly, even despite the fact that, you know, I found as much as everyone else, or as many people would have done, being abhorred by his comments on the wall and Mexico and so on, many Hispanic voters in America actually are not keen on lots of illegal immigration. So they just couldn't be treated as a one, if you see what I mean. You couldn't just go, we've got the Hispanic vote. And I think it's that tendency to, so that's one aspect of why I think there was a rejection of it. There was also a sense in which, if anything, identity politics as it's kind of in its most extreme form practiced on campuses, particularly in America, in kind of traditional liberal left circles, is to constantly see through people, to racialize people in many ways, you know, to see, for people to say, I identify as, and I've just written this book, as you said, called I Find That Offensive. So you'll have people say, you know, as a Muslim, I find that offensive. As a disabled woman, I find that offensive. As a Afro-Caribbean man, I find that offensive. And there becomes a kind of competition of what particular identity you see yourself. These things, by the way, not achievements that you've, you know, made for yourself, but things which you may be traditionally associated with, born into, some things biologically given. And so it's a kind of retreat into saying you can't criticize me or my group. And I think that that has had a very fracturing destructive influence on politics. But one of the groups that then, in the midst of this, which feels as though it's been left out, is the white Rust Belt working class in America, and potentially to throughout Europe as well, who then in turn start to see themselves as an identity group, which is of course very dangerous, because I don't want there to be, you know, a sense of the white identity any more than I want there to be the sense of the Bangladeshi identity or the Muslim identity or what have you. I think that to see ourselves in that way, with an emphasis on our difference and on the fact that we almost can only speak on behalf of the group that we are designated part of, means that we cannot transcend our particular background, our ethnicity, our cultural heritage and so on. And that just means that you get ghettoized, you get stuck in a box. And one of the parts that was liberationary about left-wing politics in the past was that, you know, when I was first involved in fighting for women's liberation or any of the kind of struggles that associated with women's fight for equality, was that it used to, you know, that as many feminists have argued, it would drive me mad that people thought that women were different to men and should be treated differently. You know, women are naturally caring, so they'll naturally be the people who'll stay at home and look after the kids. Yeah. Women should be treated, you know, women are more emotional, women are and so on and so forth, right? So we saw this as kind of some kind of sexist construct. Now, through identity politics, it's often feminism, for example, that's arguing that women are different and should be treated differently. And I think that that has led to then some very, very peculiar issues on campus. Now there's the whole gender question as well, which in this country has resulted in a big campaign to say that Oxford University have announced that they're going to only use Z as pronouns, because you shouldn't misgender people through he or she. And in America, a massive fight and a row of huge passionate attention has been given to and bathrooms, and whether there should be transgender people should be allowed to use which bathrooms. And I think that for the people who are living in parts of America where they're concerned about the state of society, worried about the economy, concerned about jobs, want to know what the future of America is, they just see this as the most trivial kind of narcissistic, self-indulgent kind of political argument. So in that sense, I think there has been something of a rejection of identity politics. Sadly, the people who are rejecting it, as in Trump supporters, they themselves then jump on the identity bandwagon by talking about the particular and special needs of the white working class. So that doesn't help either.
So you spoke about narcissism there. Do you think you can separate identity politics from narcissism? So is there anything good or interesting about identity politics?
No, I don't think there is anything interesting about identity politics. But, you know, it gets narrower and narrower. So I kind of gave, you know, I it's very hard to even caricature it. But you do get into a competition. So you start saying, you know, well, I'm you know, on behalf of lesbians using wheelchairs, you know, who are thinking of transitioning in terms of gender, you know what I mean, versus you with your different. And so it gets narrower and narrower groups. And I think that that becomes solidarity becomes impossible in those circumstances. And we're not even encouraged to transcend our differences, but in fact, we're encouraged to wallow in them. But that ultimately means, you know, the ultimate identity is oneself. You know, it's about me, me, me. And I, me, demand that you recognize my particular feelings, my suffering, rather than seeing oneself as part of a broader, you know, society. Having said all that, the interesting thing that's happened alongside kind of a shallow narcissism, and I don't think people, by the way, that's not about people kind of like staring in the mirror and going, I'm so beautiful. It's, you know, it's yeah. a different kind of narcissism. People don't realize that they're being narcissistic. It's not vanity in that sense. But on the other hand, we've also got this peculiar thing, which is the demise of the individual. Because partly one of the issues around identity that's fascinating is that it actually is an attack on one's individuality, because it only treats you as a woman or as a Muslim woman or as a transgender person, as if you are one of a type, if you see what I mean. It can't see you as an individual. And there's a lot of discussion in society about, oh, the problem is individualism, whereas I don't think there's enough individualism about, because what an individual outlook is really about in its most positive sense is about recognizing people as moral agents and capable of controlling their own destiny. That's what it's about. It's about recognizing every single individual, whether they're a peasant in the field or a prince, to use some of the old examples, or whoever you are, you have agency. You have your one life. You are able to think for yourself, to work out good from bad, and make decisions and choices and so on. And increasingly, contemporary political society actually undermines that agency. If you look at everything from kind of nanny state things, which, you know, the state takes over and makes decisions on your behalf, nudge theory, which assumes that people aren't able to be rational, a reasonable human being, able to reflect on their own society. And in the recent elections, when you asked me about that, I mean, I think what combines the Trump and the Brexit votes together is not the votes themselves so much as the response to them, in which it is assumed that the voters were somehow duped, were so stupid, weren't well enough educated to get the right answer. You know, that there's an assumption that people are not capable of being those moral agents. And, you know, once left to their own devices, they'll make the wrong decision. You know, they'll either make the wrong lifestyle choices and end up eating junk food, or driving their car too much and not caring about the environment. So we've got to step in and intervene and stop them doing the wrong thing. Or if we let them vote, well, you know, anything could happen. And I think that that kind of anti-democratic, anti-humanist aspect of the contemporary discussion is very nerve-wracking.
So that in itself, because it's interesting to talk about an explanation for why these things happen, but to kind of push it back onto the reaction of, I mean, everyone spoke about them as if they're elites, but again, that's labeling them in another kind of respect. Would you class that as an explanation as well as a reaction to what's happened? I mean, the two biggest upsets of 2016, apart from David Bowie dying.
Yeah. I think that I think there's a number of things. I think that there is no doubt about it that what we are witnessing is the unraveling of the post-war political arrangements, and the institutions have run out of steam. This had happened long before Brexit or Trump. So, but this is in a way that kind of it's come to a head in these recent events. So, for example, you know, there was a sense in which you knew that the Conservative Party had a particular ideological outlook in the past. Mm. The Labour Party had a social base and a particular political outlook. That's in the UK. And this is true throughout Europe, throughout the Western world, in fact. Political parties were well established in terms of not only, you know, historically, in terms of their social base, in terms of their ideological outlook. And voters, or, you know, society were given options by different competing political parties who would offer different, not just practical policy outcomes, but philosophical ways of viewing the world and different visions of the future. That has been in demise for some time, you know, probably, you know, 15 years or so. And, you know, really probably is located around the time of the end of the Cold War. In some ways that, maybe I can go back to that. But anyway, that's kind of where you can see that starting to happen. And then the problem then, and there is an elite and there is an establishment, and they do exist. And the political elites, regardless of their political parties, started to govern in a much more technocratic way and started to rely on kind of expertise, because it was, you know, we were told we now live in post-ideological times. Margaret Thatcher famously said in Britain, there is no alternative now, Tina, as though this was it. We've reached the end of history. There's only one way. So, you know, this way of organized society is the only one there is. Get used to it. And now it's just a question of who's the best managers to be in control. And one of the things that then happened was that they found, those political parties found themselves without a vision, if you see what I mean, had nothing to inspire people. There was no longer a kind of competing for heart and souls. It was a competition about who could manage most efficiently. And I think that the hollowing out of political parties has led to a range of things that we all know have been problematic, such as, you know, the fact that we have personality driven, you know, elections, you know what I mean? But people trying to judge people on whether they're nice or not. Yep. You know, we get that kind of thing. So all of the kind of substantial, meaningful ways that you might have decided how you might organize society have been completely squeezed out of the political process. As a consequence of that, there's become an increasing distance between that elite that's basically technocratically managing things and the vast majority of people in society who have been done to but not involved in, have been disregarded as any kind of a political player. And, you know, effectively, nobody's had any kind of serious relationship with them other than one, as I say, where they're treated as though they're incompetent and need to be managed. As a consequence of which, I think that this has been something of a rebellion, if you see what I mean. Yep. Now, it's a kind of accident of history that there was a referendum in Britain, if you see what I mean. I mean, when I say an accident of history, I don't mean to say that. But, you know,
it's,
I think
an event. It's not a...
It was an, yeah, it was an event. And I think that the truth of the matter is that that David Cameron and the British Conservative Party had the idea of having the referendum to deal with something technically within their own, you know, within their own ranks, to resolve a kind of technocratic problem of a row happening at an elite level. And they did that by holding a referendum on whether to be in the European Union. And they really did think, I think, that you could mobilise millions of people, get them to go out and vote the way you told them to. And then, you know, after that, you know, everyone would vote to stay in the EU, then we'd all get sent back home into our box, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But it gave people an opportunity, almost for the first time in living memory, it gave people an opportunity to do something. You know, that this was a vote where their vote actually counted, that the electoral system wouldn't discount their vote as it often does in British parliamentary elections. They were told it was an important vote and that they were not to be apathetic and stay at home, but they had to get involved and find out about it. And people took them at their word. And so actually millions and millions of people, it was actually quite exciting in the build up to the Brexit vote, because millions and millions of people were talking politics, young, old, indifferent, all sorts of social classes were saying, what do you think? What do you think? Googling, reading newspapers, reading websites, doing their own research, talking to neighbours, take the kids to school and everyone's saying, what are you going to do? What do you think? It was a very lively, vibrant moment where suddenly people felt that their vote might count. And so they were mobilised. And I think that, first of all, it was a genuine rejection of the European Union. because the European Union in their minds symbolized that technocratic above democracy managerial approach. And the opposite was this idea of national sovereignty became an expression of the way that people wanted to assert that they did want some control over their future and their lives. And so in that sense, people took the opportunity to vote to take more control of their lives through the particular issue of the European Union.
I don't think
America was the same, but there were just only correlation is that I think the idea that Hillary Clinton, you know, as Bill Clinton said, it's Hillary's time. This idea of kind of like the anointment, we will anoint you, Hillary Clinton, because it's your time. You deserve this. You know, you are obviously the best technocratic politician. That just didn't work. And even the Republicans lost control of their own leadership elections. And it was almost as though Donald Trump represented the person that the establishment couldn't control, whereby the populace decided that they were somebody he would. In that sense, he represented the we don't want to be told what to do by the establishment. We want to have some say in our own future. And in that sense, I'm very positive about both votes. But I am negative about the outcome of Trump, who I think is all of the things that people dread him to be. And I am positive about Britain leaving the European Union, which I don't think is in any way a bad thing. I think it's actually a positive thing.
That was great to hear a humanist perspective on national sovereignty. That hasn't really got articulated enough, I don't think. It's good. To wrap things up, I mean, the Echo Chamber Club is all about challenging perspectives, trying to get people out of their filter bubbles. Are there any websites, articles, books, podcasts that you'd recommend to our readers to learn more about the things that you've just spoken about?
Well, a couple of caveats before I say that. I think what everybody needs to do is to think twice about what language is used. So I started off saying that I was a liberal. You know, I stand in the spirit of John Locke and J.S. Mill and all the rest of it. But I'm also spend a lot of my time attacking liberals. If you know what I mean. So, yeah. You know, there's lots of liberals. So I suddenly realised, oh, I don't even know what liberalism means myself. But the reason I say that is because one of the words that's used constantly now to assault people or criticise them or insult them is, oh, you're just a populist. And I think that we should maybe know that whilst there is a dangerous aspect of populism historically, that at the moment populism is often used to attack the popular and the people. And so we have to be careful about just bandying around those phrases. And I'm at my absolutely end of my tether of everyone saying that we're having a rerun of the 30s and fascism's around the corner. Everybody's a fascist. Everyone's a misogynist. Everyone's a white supremacist. And these labels become incredibly destructive ways of avoiding what you're trying to do, which is the need to actually listen to each other and open up the debate, rather than closing it down by simply smearing people. And it also means that we end up crying wolf, by the way, because if everybody's a misogynist, white supremacist, fascist, then, you know, you end up in a situation where some of those things are actually really happening. We can't spot them because we've misused the language. In terms of websites, I mean, the fellow website of the Institute of Ideas is the Spiked Online website, which is an incredibly important publication here in terms of the articles it publishes. And I would suggest people look at that. And it has its own podcast. And we at the Institute of Ideas, in fact, have our podcast. So you should listen to some of those as well. I think that the American long form essay in terms of worth reading, particularly the New Yorker. I find going to read some of those longer, more considered essays incredibly important at the moment. You just want to avoid the kind of soundbite snapshots. There's also a interesting project in the UK called British Futures that's run by Sundra Katwala, which has tried to take a different type of view on why people might be being patriotic. It's kind of looking at the whole issue about what nationhood means, what nationalism might mean. And I think that's had some very interesting and insightful work produced recently. And I'm also very keen on the work of Jamie Bartley and colleagues at Demos, who've tried to understand with a bit more depth than some of the less nuanced arguments about so-called extremist groups and what's happening in terms of what extremes are, and kind of just being a bit sort of interesting and interested. But, you know, the main thing is, and I could go on, you know, and there's lots of books that you should read, but I mean, that's, I can maybe list them somewhere else. Well, the main thing I would say is that people have just got to read around, you know, that you know, I really like The Spectator, which I sometimes write in, which comes at things that from kind of historically from a more right-wing point of view. But it would be ridiculous if I only read things I thought were going to support what I think. Mm. So in the UK, I also read The New Statesman and The Guardian and articles written by people I disagree with, because I've got to be open-minded enough to read sufficiently across the range and not to simply just confirm myself in my own echo chamber, which is why I'm delighted to do this podcast, and I think this initiative is well worth supporting.
Thanks very much for saying so, Claire. It's always good to hear stuff like that. No, I think those are great recommendations. I think that the main issue that people have, though, that perhaps people like me and you don't, who kind of do this full time, is just time, which is why we've kind of slipped into this, the notion of an echo chamber as well, which I think is well worth debating, despite the fact that I've named something after it. But anyway,
no, but I think that we all need people to help us make choices in terms of what to read, which is why what you're doing is great. And I think that, you know, if somebody can provide one with a reading list, then, you know, it's always worth trying to come along. We've got a residential summer school in the summer, believe it or not, in July, on the self and narcissism, historically and philosophically, by the way, which is just 2 or 3 days where we all go away, about 200 of us. I wanted to say that I think you'd really enjoy it, but it's also got a fantastic reading list as well, which I'll send you.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that does sound like something I'd enjoy. Presumably that's in the UK, because we've got a couple of American listeners as well. But
yes,
we'll put
it's in the UK, but if I could just say, last year, I think we had about 6 or 7 people came from the US, from the United States. They did fund themselves, but they did come along for that very weekend. So, you know, all welcome wherever you are.
Yes, we'll all come. Good. Well, thank you very much for your ideas and your work, Claire. And thanks very much for coming on the Echo Chamber podcast.
I appreciate talking to you. Good luck with the project. And I'm sure there's lots of joint work that we can do in the future.
So that was me talking to Claire Fox earlier this week about identity politics, about liberal humanism, about sovereignty, and also about the crisis of post-war political arrangements and institutions. Great to hear some of her recommendations about what you can read to get out of an echo chamber, and I hope that you join us next time when we're speaking to Yoshi Herman. Thanks for listening to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. I'm Alice Thwaite. This episode was produced by Rebecca Houston. Music by Emmanuel Dosa and Roof Now. Subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. Please find the rest of our content and contact details on echochamber.club.